We're here at Sunset and Vine, not out on the corner, but inside the Pacific Pioneer Broadcasters Clubhouse for a unique opportunity to talk with four people who contributed a tremendous amount to the radio days, all of them known as announcers, although Les Tremaine, who is with us, is a triple threat man. He was an announcer from time to time. He was an actor. And this last weekend, he's acted as a producer for us as we set up an awful lot of conversations with folks out here in La La Land. And we really appreciate all the work that Les has done for us.
Dresser, I sing, too.
Okay. Dresser Dahlstedt is here, John Milton Kennedy, and Wendell Niles. John M. Kennedy was the announcer of most regard, I guess, on the Lux Radio Theater through most of the 1940s and many other things. We're going to hear about that. Dresser Dahlstedt was the man who introduced the Old Ranger on the Death Valley Days program for Pacific Coast Borax Company. And Wendell Niles was the man who said, and now the Lieber Brothers, the makers of Pepsodent, present Bob Hope. Wendell. Glad to have you with us today. You announced for Bob Hope for how long?
I think we did about 7 or 8 years. I have the scars to prove it. It was a long, all through the war.
All through the war. So you would travel with Bob from camp to camp then and all those shows?
Yeah, I didn't go overseas with him because I had to stay and do the shows. We were on 52 weeks out of the year, you know, for Pepsodent.
Mm-hmm. And, no summer break on those?
No.
Hope shows?
No, usually not. We did when he was traveling, usually I did the shows locally. And trying to think now. It's hard for me when I try to think. Something always happens.
You're not alone, kiddo.
Yeah.
Something to be said for no.
Oh, I had a lot of fun. We have great. Bob just lives 2 blocks from me down in, over in Toluca Lake.
So you're still, you get to see him every once in a while.
Oh, yeah. He's great. He's 2 years older than I am, and you know, I learned to respect my elders. And he's a wonderful guy. He was a great person to be with all the time. I mean, there's a lot of fun, a lot of laughs.
On the Hope shows, as I understand it, there would be an hour-long non-broadcast, an hour-long rehearsal in front of an audience after which they would start editing material for the half-hour show. Didn't that happen for some time?
No.
Okay, nothing. This is it. Thank you and good night.
I can tell you, Lenny, times we didn't rehearse at all. I remember so we were the number one show on the air at that time. I remember many times like we'd be doing something like in St. Louis and out of one of those camps. And you get out of a staff car and go on stage and immediately do our show. No rehearsal. Many times, none at all.
Just hand you the script and away it would go.
Yeah, that's right. We'd had it sometimes to review the script in the staff car, but many times we didn't have any rehearsal. I never heard about that. Other, we did many shows do that. I know they will...
Well, I have read that Hope did that. Maybe it was earlier than the 40s. When you joined Bob in
41.
Oh boy, you were right at the beginning of all of those camp shows.
Yeah,
he was
that's
the first
true.
One to do all of that sort of thing.
Yeah, I was. I got it's always amazing to me to look in New York things and see who did my shows. Like Bill Goodwin gets most of the credit for being in the Hope Show and a few other people. I've got a thing they did. I suppose you guys all did the same thing. They put out a book on the people who were in the Walk of Fame. And I got a nice picture, a big picture, almost a half. And I got 2 shows that they gave me credit for it. I never heard of either one of them.
We'll rattle off a bunch of your credits. Bob Hope Show, Lum and Abner, The Man Called X with Herbert Marshall. You were on When a Girl Marries. You announced that show. Philip Marlowe, Charlotte Greenwood, The Fitch Bandwagon.
Yeah, thousands of them.
All kinds of stuff. You worked with Al Pierce for a number of years, too.
5 years, as with Al.
Nobody home. I hope, I hope, I hope, I hope,
yeah.
Huh?
Yeah, people forget, you know. Isn't that amazing how He was a, one of the biggest performers we had on the air.
Mm-hmm.
And you would say, Al Pierce? I don't know. What do you do? But, again, he'll, they know his catchphrase.
Mm-hmm.
Elmer Blurt.
Elmer Blurt, yeah.
Yeah,
that was...
He's a good performer.
Those were interesting programs. He had somebody on that show did a Tizzy Lish.
That was Tizzy Lish.
Well, but that was a man was Tizzy Lish.
Yeah, that's right.
Was that
he
Al?
Called himself. He lived right up the next block from me. Yes, he was very good.
Comstock. Bill, was it Bill Comstock? I think it was Bill Comstock. Who
yeah,
did
that's close.
Tizzy.
We always call him Tizzy Lish. I remember on that show with Al Pierce, I remember, you know, Man of a Thousand Voices, Mel Blanc.
Mm-hmm.
And Mel was making $75. And he was getting a lot of laughs and things. So I went to Bob and I said, Al, I said, this, you know, a dollar was worth a dollar in those days. Nobody made a whole lot of money. But I said, $75 is not enough for a guy like this, and I think you should pay him more money. So he said, all right. So they doubled his salary, got him $150. And Mel never forgot that. He gave me a beautiful cigarette case with solid gold money, right? But and here, you know, he ended up one of the richest people in Hollywood. That's enough about me now. Have you seen my latest picture?
I mean, well, we're going to get back to you, Wendell Niles. I want to talk with John Milton Kennedy for a couple of minutes. You were one of the premier announcers on the Lux Radio Theater for a number of years, right?
I did it from 1942 to 52.
10 years.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Were you the man who said, Lux presents Hollywood?
Yes.
And, of course, talked about the Lever Brothers commercial products, too.
Yes. And I was always proud of the fact that the head of Lever Brothers at the time was Charles Luckman, who later was known as an architect in partnership with Pereira.
He was an architect.
He had started out as an architect, as a matter of fact. But Charles Luckman, who I think his father was in the druggist business, a pharmacist, and he... somebody snapping pictures?
Oh,
yes. Yeah. Of course.
You're not used to it, John, but go ahead.
Go ahead anyway.
Never bothered me.
He worked as... Mr. Luckman worked his way up to the head of Pepsodent Company, and he was head of Pepsodent. Pepsodent or Pepsodent, something like that, while sponsoring the Bob Hope Show. And then he later, from Pepsodent, became head of Lever Brothers Company while Lux was on the air, mm-hmm. when I was on it. And his parents, God love them, delightful, beautiful people, used to, the word is not really bum, but used to ask me for tickets to the show, mm-hmm. to the Lux Radio Theater show. And I was always delighted to provide them with tickets. The people would wait out front mm-hmm. to get into these shows. And this was at the... the Vine Street Theater, which is now the Doolittle Theater. And I first went to the Vine Street Theater as a kid in high school. I took my sweetheart there to see Edward Everett Horton in Arms and the Man by George Bernard Shaw. That was, 1928? That dates me, doesn't it? Yeah. I was in high school in 1928.
A few years later, you're back on the stage.
Yes.
I should say 1928
to 42, whatever it is. Yeah. But that's how I became acquainted with Mr. and Mrs. Luckman, the father of Charles Luckman. He later left Lever Brothers Company. I think they got rid of him because he was spending too much money on traveling to London, the headquarters of Lever Brothers.
I can tell you about that, John, if you want to know the real truth.
What is the real truth?
Be careful.
Chuck Luckman, yeah, I was with him. He was a very close personal friend of mine, as a matter of fact. And when they did make him, and he was the head of Lever Buzz, which is one of the largest corporations in the world, and they were Boston, or what is the place next to Boston where they, you know, where the Lever Brothers plant was? What is it down? That doesn't make a difference. It's a whole city, a little city right across. And...
Gee, we're helpful, Luckman.
Yeah. I don't know.
Chuck was never really received in Boston, and it made him very mad. So So he built, unbeknownst to everybody, I guess, built this building in New York, which is still there. And D-Day, he gave everybody it was a wonderful operation. It was like a Storm and Norman. You know, you couldn't do it any better. He was a brilliant man. But one morning, Cambridge, is that the town?
Cambridge.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Cambridge, man.
They went to sleep, everybody. It's a big place. You know, that was the heart and soul of Lever Brothers.
You sure it's Cambridge?
They went to school, and they went to sleep that night. The next morning, there was nobody there. Absolutely empty. They all had their orders. They all went to New York, and they've all moved into this building. That's why they fired him. That's why Lever Brothers did. But it was a fantastic operation.
He moved. And then he decided to go. He had studied architecture in school.
He was a Pereira. They were both in school.
He admit Pereira in school, and then they decided to join their forces and became outstanding architects. And then later when I was, what was I doing at CBS? I think it was Life with Luigi. The main studios, CBS TV studios in town at Beverly and 4th, mm-hmm. They pronounce it 5X. It's not Fairfax there. It's Fairfax with a slight Eastern accent. And he had done was the architecture for that architect for that building.
Yeah.
I had great pleasure treading those boards and some commercials I did there.
The Lux Radio Theater took up a lot of your time, John, but there you certainly had other programs that you were announcing on radio at that same time through the 40s.
Not very many, really. Not very many, let's face it. I had met your guest this morning, my longtime friend, Dresser Dahlstedt, Blue Network.
Who?
When Dresser...
waiting in the wings over here.
Where? What? Dresser, he's on my left. This is Dresser Dahlstedt over. He hired me as an announcer on the Blue Network, which later became the American Broadcasting Company, in February 42. At the same time, he hired Paul Masterson and Hank Weaver. Hank Weaver used to say, this is a 15-minute build-up to a frog in your throat, because all we said, this is ABC, the American Broadcasting Company, at the end of a program. Well, I was on staff there and had wanted to augment my income and did some work as an actor from time to time, and Sandy Barnett at J. Walter Thompson hired me as an actor on Lux in May, I think it was, 42, and then later had the auditions, and I was chosen. And one of the things he told me before he passed away recently was that among the competition for that job of announcer was one of his neighbors. Hold still for this. Chet Huntley.
Oh,
and you see how good that was for Chet Huntley. Not he went from there to many great things.
Yeah, good guy.
I was on staff, at Blue Network, the American Broadcasting Company, with special permission to do this job on CBS. And what was the name of man Dresser that gave permission for me to do that show on CBS when I was chosen?
I would guess Don Gilman, probably. He was the
I think it was a man under Don Gilman, and they thought it was pretty nice for this was Blue Network staff, and they thought it was pretty nice for a guy to be chosen to do a CBS show like that. And what was I going to say? What's my name? how soon do you have to know?
Gone in Brokenshire? We were talking a few moments ago while we were waiting there and looking at some of those old pictures on the wall there, and John remembered that he had auditioned when he was on a small station in L.A. He'd auditioned for Ken Carpenter, who was the chief announcer at KFI. And KFI rejected him. So I don't know what that means about me. I hired him.
You hired him. Well, this is Dresser Dahlstedt.
In the meantime, I got better. That's why.
Yeah. That was a good staff. It really was. Excellent. George Fenneman was later on the staff, so we had quite a collection there.
Some dirty son of a gun came out from Chicago, if you'll pardon the expression.
Watch it.
He was... He came out to be head of the program department or something like that, and he found out that I was doing a CBS show. He terminated my permission. And at the same time, I think George Fenneman was on staff at the American Broadcasting Company. Pardon me. And George would skip out, getting somebody to cover him at ABC, sometimes me even, while he went over to CBS to do a warm-up for Sweeney
and March.
Sweeney.
Oh, yeah.
And March, the comedy show. This dirty guy from Chicago, pardon the expression, found out that George was bugging out, and I was doing this, and so our permission terminated, as I remembered it. And then I started announcing a soap opera. Oh, what the heck was the name of it? Not Today's Children or something like that, but...
Closing up.
Is that
sounds like it.
Well, there was a Today's Children.
That was so popular, doesn't it? They terminated the leads, the male and female leads on that show, and hired... Frank Lovejoy's wife. But at the time, they were separated.
Joan Banks.
Uh-huh. Yes, thank you. Yes, and an excellent actress. They were separated, and the producer of that show, this great big guy with a heart as soft as jello, he found out that they were separated. So he cast Frank in the part opposite Joan Banks, and they came together again.
Oh, that's nice.
What was his name? Oh, I loved the guy. He would direct a soap opera with a straight face. You never snickered at these lines.
How could he?
No, how could he? See, there's an answer who says, how could he? He
wasn't never snickered. Joe Ainley, was it?
Axel Gruenberg.
Gruenberg, yes.
I loved the guy. I loved the guy. He was so...
He was so professorial.
Yes, yeah. But so sincere about and never cracked a smile during rehearsal. I never saw a flicker of anything... comedic on his face. It was serious as the Dickens to him.
Oh, but he had a lot underneath.
I learned then how to be a soap opera actor. I never did a soap opera job, but you say a line, somebody says a line, you pause, and then you answer. And then you say part of a line, and you break it up. And then finish the line. And the next guy pauses before he picked it.
Well, they didn't have much of a script, you know. I remember once on a show in New York, LCBB, Life Can Be Beautiful.
LCBB, Life Can Be Beautiful.
It sort of... well, that's another story. It took them 4 weeks to go up a few floors in an elevator, talking all the time. Sorry to interrupt.
That's all right.
Let's move over to Dresser Dahlstedt for a couple of minutes. Dresser, you were the announcer for so many programs during the heyday of radio.
Just getting back to Death Valley days, it's interesting that at that particular time, it was originating in New York, and of course at that time you couldn't record anything, and Pacific Coast Borax, they wanted the show on at a certain time on the West Coast, so we actually did a repeat show live in San Francisco. They did the one in New York early, but we had no way to record it, so we did an actual, got their scripts, did the same show with a very good cast in San Francisco at that time.
Why wouldn't they repeat it in New York?
There was no way. You couldn't do it.
Programs were broadcast
not
twice.
Not that time. Not that time.
This is earlier.
Was it ever? You don't realize
how this was in the early 30s then. That's
it was about 1935, 36, right. Somewhere along there.
Yeah. My golly, that's a new one. I've never heard that.
I know there was a West Coast Whistler and a Midwest Whistler. They had, it was the same script, but there was a Whistler out here by the Signal Oil Company for the West Coast, that sort of thing.
Do you know that the Whistler on the Whistler was a girl? At least out here.
You mean the actual whistle?
I wish you hadn't said that.
It wasn't Muzzy Marcellino.
I guess it could have been. Yeah.
People don't really realize back in those years in 1936 mm-hmm. when I was back there in San Francisco, they don't realize, you know, what we were doing on the West Coast. There was probably the Red and Blue Network in New York, but on the West Coast we had our own designations called the Gold and the Orange Network. We did everything live out of San Francisco. At that time, NBC, so high and mighty, they wouldn't play a record. No way they'd put a record. And for years and years that went on. And so we had a great, Meredith Wilson was on our staff there, big orchestra, singers, actors, a regular stock country company. Mm-hmm. So we really run two networks and two stations from 7 in the morning till midnight. So we really did an awful lot of live shows out there, which was great, great fun for an announcer.
We always knew about the Red and the Blue Network of the National Broadcasting, but not the Gold and the, what was the other, the Silver?
Gold and the Orange.
Gold and Orange Network.
Well,
out here in California, it had to be an Orange Network, I guess.
Well,
NBC used to say CBS was 11.
Yeah. The Golden State. When we built this building, that's when they changed the designation to the Red and the Blue, which was already in existence in New York.
At that time, when you were out in San Francisco, that city was more of a hub for Western radio than L.A., right?
That was the central broadcast headquarters. Hal Perry, Oh, great cast up there. Mm-hmm. Carlton Morse started there. Yeah. One Man's Family began there.
Well, you worked with him a little bit, didn't you?
I worked with Carlton.
Mm-hmm. Quite a bit.
Got to know him quite a bit, right. And then down here, of course, I was fortunate enough to do I Love a Mystery with him for quite a few years, which was just a great show to work on with Carlton and all the actors. He did hire a lot of actors and actresses on I Love a Mystery. Great shows.
When did you come down here?
1938, this building. I came in the day they moved in here.
I did the first show from here. I came here in 35, but...
38, because... when I first came down, and NBC was doing everything they had down there on Don Lee, on Melrose, next to the Grotto. Mm. And so when I came down, they were just beginning to open the studios here.
We're sitting in a pretty nostalgic spot right here.
Yeah, I bet.
Well, I'll say.
I think all of us have done thousands of shows right here upstairs.
Yeah.
Yep.
Never forget it.
Yeah, I'll say. Yeah.
Wonderful stories.
Yeah.
Oh. Beautiful.
I guess some of the most exciting things I can remember out of San Francisco were the Golden Gate Bridge and the Bay Bridge, because at that time, NBC would like to have descriptions of progress of the bridges. We had a special events man, Don Thompson, who was an ex-football player, huge big fellow, and he would just automatically assign us to these things. And one of the things he assigned me to was when the bridge was being built, with the catwalk still just barely starting, he sent me to the tower of the San Francisco side with an engineer. And I tell you, when I look back at that, and I look at that now, and I think, how in the world? But NBC at the time, you know, they said to do it as an announcer. You thought, I better do it. They'll fire me if I don't. So I went up on the top of that bridge, and on the opening day, I was on the Marin Tower describing the opening of the bridge. So... that was really pretty exciting.
I bet you were making about $35 a week.
Just about, John. I think. I think
that's a lot of money.
But everything was so cheap then. My gosh, you get a whole dinner for 75 cents with a cocktail.
I'm sorry they brought that up.
I have to say that Dressers got one on all the Chicago actors who used to claim they couldn't get to the Merchandise Mart or the Wrigley Building because the bridge was up. Dresser was up on the bridge.
How high was that? Oh, gee whiz, up. Several hundred.
Up a lot.
Yeah.
Just don't look down.
When I look up now and I think, I don't believe I ever did that.
What an experience.
Yeah.
Les Tremaine, of course, is well known as the leading man on the First Nighter program, as the thin man on so many radio broadcasts.
30,000.
You were an announcer with Bob Crosby on the Old Gold Show and in Chicago in the 30s, I guess it was. Dr. Herman N. Bundensen, who was the president of the Board of Health, had a program, and you announced that show for him, too, right?
Yeah, I'd been in radio by that time since 1930, and this was a big break. It was an hour show, 5 days a week, and I was hired to be the announcer, the personal announcer for Dr. Bundensen, which was quite a feather in my cap, and also to, we had a soap opera on this hour. We had 20 minutes of news events, a la the March of Time, and I was the guy who was given all the various voices. I sang for Paul Robeson. I played FDR before he became president, you know, that sort of thing.
You made him president.
And they called me and they said, you're going to do FDR tomorrow morning. And I said, who's he? And they said, there's a one-minute recording tonight of a speech he made. And I listened to that and then had to go on the next morning and be FDR.
I'm impressed.
And oh, boy. But this show, I had to get up at 4 o'clock every morning in order to get there for rehearsal because we went on the air at 9 o'clock in the morning, and I had no automobile, and I had to make 3 streetcar changes in order to get there. It was a WLS on the west side of Chicago on Washington Boulevard. Mm-hmm. And we did everything on that show. We had to be up on current news events in case the script wasn't written. And the guy was in the... Herb Hutram was his name, and he was in the control room typing up the script. And if he didn't get the page out to you, you had to ad lib. And had to make it halfway decent, you know, with a conclusion and so on. One day, Bundensen didn't show. And it's no wonder. Outside, as you know, Chuck, the streets were like glass. It was the middle of winter, and they had tried to clear the streets, but they were covered with this sheet of ice. And we sweated it and sweated it. And we were on the air by now. All of a sudden, we heard this siren coming down Washington Boulevard right through the... It was just... The studios were nothing like they are now, you know. They weren't soundproofed or anything. And we rushed to this window in one of the offices to see what was coming. And here was Bundensen coming in his chauffeur limousine. And he was going about 1 mile an hour down the sheet of ice. He got there for the conclusion of the show. But that was a great experience. I made $20 a week on that.
Hey.
5 hours a week.
Those were the days.
Yeah, hell yeah. I bought myself a 1929 Studebaker.
Sure.
This was 1934 by then. And I paid $244, and the $4 was the tax, the sales tax. And I spent about $500 trying to fix it up and finding out rid of it.
We're having a good time talking with 4 announcers from the radio days, Les Tremaine, Dresser Dahlstedt, John Milton Kennedy, and Wendell Niles. And we're going to take a short break, and then we're going to come back and have some more stories. John?
Yes, I wanted
to... Your hand is raised. We want us to take a little longer break? You need to
No, no. I wanted to mention at this point that the man in the control room here is Norman Dews.
Yes.
Norman Dews, baby. I met in 1935, at XEBC Agua Caliente. I hired on a...
Was he a wetback?
No, he was the engineer at XEBC, if you please. And we were on a... not a salary. It was so much a week, but...
A retainer?
No, room and board. It was room and board kind of a thing. And he tells me this many years later, for goodness sakes, that when I came on as the announcer, he was bumped out of this classy room in this Mexican hotel. And we were on Mexican food. The board was Mexican food 3 times a day, breakfast, lunch, and dinner, Mexican food. I left, so.
Yeah.
Well, Norman Dews and Marty Halperin here are volunteers from the Pacific Pioneer Broadcasters, yes, right. Are the gentlemen of distinction behind the controls at this little get-together, and we sure appreciate that.
What would we do without?
And we are in wonderful surroundings here in the clubhouse. All around us are wonderful photographs of the Pioneer Broadcasters. There are radio sets that won't quit around here are some of the old cathedral radios and the early crystal sets, and everything is all around here, and some microphones that we see are just incredible. And
lots of old things around
Marty
here.
Marty and Norman are working on vintage equipment that's been kept in tip-top shape by the pioneers, so we're glad to be doing that. So you stick around, don't go away, and as they used to say, don't touch that dial. We're talking with Wendell Niles, John Milton Kennedy, Dresser Dahlstedt, and Les Tremaine, people who, my gosh, I would say together represent...
$52 billion.
Oh, dollars. I was thinking of years.
That's what I was going to say. I'm afraid he was going to say years.
Oh, you'd rather. should we talk net worth instead of so many years? A lot of years of radio.
Net worth.
Les mentioned that we should describe where we are more. We should actually talk a little bit about the NBC studios that were originally on this site. Each of you worked at NBC at one time or another, or for many years during your career.
As a matter of fact, speaking of NBC, I was on ABC staff, and I took an audition for an ABC comedy show, one of the big comedians. And it was a show that ran for years and years and years, and I was told by the producer that I was chosen to announce it. And then I was on staff, as I say, at ABC, and went to see what the heck was his name on the second floor at NBC.
John Swallow, by any chance?
Not Swallow, no. Swallow was a good guy. This was one of the awful guys. But he told me, since I was on staff at ABC, I couldn't accept this job. And I said, why? Why? And he said, it's NBC policy.
Oh, yeah.
That's where they were.
And NBC policy was
pretty rugged, I'll say. Yeah.
There was a guy. Well, there was a guy on what's it called? Variety. What was his name? He did a long time column for
you
years.
Mean the show? Carol. Dish?
Carol.
Jack Hellman.
Jack Hellman. Yeah. At his retirement party.
Good catch, Marty.
At his retirement party, it was presided over by, goodness gracious, this man's name.
Him.
Anyway, he said that when Jack Hellman's, when his bar mitzvah was catered by the Salvation Army. anyway. joke over.
Well, to get back to the orientation, we're at Sunset and Vine. This bank building is on a slant. It cuts across the corner, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
There was to be a parking lot or a parking area under the bank building. And they found that was not feasible when they built this building that we are in now, after the NBC building was torn down. Mm-hmm. And about where we are, as closely as I've been able to figure it out, is where Studio B was, which was right above here. Studio B or C?
Yeah, about that.
Yeah. There was A, B, C, and D. We have a model right over here, as you can see, mm-hmm, ladies and gentlemen.
Just look. Professor, hold the mic up over there so our listening audience can see that. Yeah.
Better take it away.
Okay. Okay. But a model of the NBC studios, we should say, rather than a model of...
That's right.
Like Playboy.
Or like Lubbock and Broad. Yeah.
That's a different story. I
I was in Chicago when the Palmolive Building was built, which later became the Playboy mm-hmm. Building. So you're on my way.
It's no longer the Playboy Building.
It is no longer?
They have their own building now. I don't remember what it's called now. But
I wonder if it went back to Palmolive.
I don't think so. I don't think so.
This was a wonderful location because NBC had this one on the corner. Mm-hmm. CBS was just a couple of blocks down the street. Mutual down the other way on Vine Street. And everybody was around. The agencies were just up the street on Hollywood Boulevard.
The Taft Building.
What's the other building? The
Echo.
I almost said it.
The Echo Building?
I used to have anybody ever go to my nightclub across the street? You weren't here, but were any of you people around? Right across, you know, where Brenneman's place was.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yeah. Tom Brenneman.
That's one of my great mistakes.
Well, you had an orchestra, didn't you, at one time?
Oh, yeah. Well, that was many years ago. That was when I always started in the business. But I was thinking, we're talking about this whole location around here. And I made a few mistakes. I had that I should have known better. That factory that I had, I should have known that buggy whips weren't anymore. And I made a lot of mistakes, but this is one of them. We opened this. It's called the Wendell Niles Gag Club.
And is that a kind of a gag?
The one that gagged on it. Yeah, but it was. I had 11 bartenders.
Yeah.
And it was quite a place. The only thing we needed, were customers. the bartenders did very, very well. They did just fine. And I said, fellas, let's leave a little, and maybe we can laugh.
Somebody may come in.
But that was when this was ever in full swing. Yeah. Oh, we could tell stories about this wonderful building upstairs and what it was.
Yeah.
I remember, we remember Dresser during the war, we had to have a little...
Little identification.
But they were very, very particular.
Oh.
What was in here, I don't know why it would carry.
Well, I can tell you, right after television started to come in, one afternoon, there was a shipping dock just beyond the artist entrance.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, here.
And a couple of at NBC, Hollywood. And a couple of guys in a big truck backed in. Down that driveway that was there, up to the shipping dock, they had on coveralls, white coveralls. They looked very professional, And they went inside, and they came out with a grand piano, which is pretty darn big, as you know.
Oh, still in my...
And either one or two television cameras, which were very big in those days.
Oh, yeah.
Wheeled them out, put them on the truck, and drove up. Just like that.
Unauthorized.
Yeah.
Unauthorized. That parking lot.
Did you ever hear that story?
No, I never had.
Sorry, I made it up.
Oh.
that's why I never heard
the story.
That parking lot was special for me. We lived for about 5 years on Holly Hill Terrace, which was up the street, up the hill, on a steep hill off Coinga. And I had an early morning shift at ABC on Sunday mornings. I think I had to be there at 5 o'clock, something like that. And this was in wartime, and gas was rationed. And so I would open the garage door, let my car roll out of the garage, stop it, and close the garage door without even starting it. It rolled down this steep driveway onto Coinga Boulevard, south on Coinga to Yucca. Well, this without starting the engine, over Yucca to Vine Street here, and down Vine Street, if you please, clear into the parking lot, the NBC parking lot, without even starting the car.
Never did warm it up.
Somebody told me, I was telling this story, they said, yeah, but you had to use twice the gas to get back up the hill the next day.
You're getting great mileage at that time.
I wouldn't advise that for anyone.
Not now.
I don't mean to put a damper on this, but I lost a very dear friend up at the ranch about 2 years ago because he did that when he didn't have to.
Was he drunk?
Go down the steep hill from his house to the little country road that we live on. And he didn't make it. And he went down an embankment about, 75, 100 feet. Crushed himself to death.
Oh, dear.
He didn't have the control he should have had.
We used to...
So don't do that again.
No, I promise.
We used to share when ABC came in, Blue Network came in, we shared an awful lot of offices together in this building.
Mm-hmm.
And on Vine Street, as John is remembering a little while ago, the announcers, of course, could sit there and look out Vine Street and all these pretty girls and everything up walking up and down the street.
Ooh, the bloods!
Pretty good. But sharing the announcers, there was a wonderful fellow by the name of Buddy Twiss. I think you remember Buddy.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
He was in, at that time, he was supervisor announcers at night for the NBC, and I was doing that for ABC. And I remember one time, this was during the war when they're first starting and everything, and Hank Weaver, who I don't think he would, I wouldn't know much about him in the East, I guess, but he was quite a character here on the West Coast. And Hank, big fellow, he came into the office one day, and Buddy Twiss was a great one to put people on. And he said, just casually announced, isn't that interesting? They're going to conscript all the dogs. You're going to take all your dogs and put them in the army. And Hank Weaver reared up and he said, they're not going to get my dog out of here. No way. And, oh, he carried on like something awful.
Charlie Weaver. You remember Charlie?
Oh, Charlie.
Oh,
yeah.
Charlie. Gosh. Used to be the Derby up the street, of course, where everybody met. And he,
Cliff Arquette.
Yeah. You met a lot of good friends there.
Yes, indeed.
But I had an idea. That was after Charlie quit. You know, what was his name?
Cliff Arquette.
Cliff Arquette. Yeah, well, Cliff, he quit because he had he retired. But I had an idea that was really great for him, an old man, just perfectly fit his character. So I called Charlie one day. I said, Charlie, let's have lunch. I got an idea I want to talk to you about. He said, not me, boy. He said, I'm through. I worked for the government and the three wives long enough. He said, hell with it. I'm not going to mess with it. So I said, well, let's get to it. Let's have lunch anyway. So we went down to the Brown Derby, and he said, you understand, of course, that I don't want any part of this business from now on. This is it. I said, sure, Charlie. I understand that. Cliff. So I started to tell him anyway. I said, this is what I had in mind anyway. I got into it. He said, yeah, and here's what we'll do. He said, then we'll do it. Well, then, but the sad part of the story was there was a guy representing Jack Parr, one of his advanced men or whatever he did, a scout. He happened to be in the Derby at the same time, and he saw Charlie or Cliff, and he said he got that idea in his mind. He said he'd be great on the Parr show, and they gave him a contract, you know, that he couldn't refuse, and that started him all over again.
Yeah.
That was a whole brand new thing. He forgot about the wives and everything.
Sure.
Anyway, it's a sad story. It
started a big career again.
Oh yeah,
I cried about it.
Wendell, who was Don Prindle?
Well, Don Prindle was my partner. We did a show on the Blue Network, incidentally, coast to coast for Hires Root Beer.
Oh, yeah.
And we did it originally. We started at CBS. We did a with Prindle. And Prindle was a writer. He was one of the very good gag writers.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And we had the show here. Chuck Huntley, incidentally, Chet Huntley was our announcer. And Chet is a good friend of mine. We grew up together. He was from Bozeman, Montana, and I was from Livingston. And we're about the same age. But he was our announcer. But one of the top people in a network heard us one time. We were just doing it at Brittingham's.
Brittingham.
Yeah, where everybody ate and went across. You know. And when I was at Lum and Abner, you waited until you heard that organ, and then you get up and you went over and said, good evening, here we are.
You mean you stayed in the place until it was time?
Oh, yeah. Sure. You walk across and go in, and Ann Leaf River was playing the organ. You say, good evening, ladies and gentlemen, here we are, Lum and Abner. They didn't have anything prepared either. Half the time, they didn't know what they were going to do.
No,
it didn't make any difference. Where was I? I was talking about Prindle,
Don Prindle.
So We were having lunch at Brittingham's, and we told something about, I don't remember what it was, or anything. We're always clowning. Prendle and I at a place up at Lake Malibu, talking about our boat or something. I said, is it fine? But it was something wrong with the plumbing every time in our cottage. You flush the toilet, you had to go down and bail out our sailboat. Nobody. Well, he laughed so hard that he literally threw up, at, in those days, $3 steak, you know, which would be 12 today. So he said, these guys are that funny, we got to put them on. So anyway, we were sold to, this is kind of a, interesting, really, now that I think about it. You know, we sold and we did the... And now it's Prendle's job for hires root beer. And it went until the war, and they couldn't make any more. The old man Hires, I don't know whether you know him. You might have, Leslie, you might know of him. He was
a very religious
man.
He lived down
man.
The road.
Oh, yeah. He had 12 roots, you know, Pip Siskoa and a few of those things. He says the only root beer fit to drink, and it probably was. And, but anyway, he couldn't get any more sugar when the war was on, so he quit.
Hmm.
Boom, they didn't make any Hires root beer the rest of the war, you know. And so that ended us. But the interesting thing that I, people talk about the velvet fog, what the...
Mel Torme.
Yeah. They said, you like Mel Torme? I said, yeah, I hired him. I started him in the business. Which, you know, everybody laughs. And so if you come to my house, which I hope you all will someday, and I see the plaque that you gave me is there, and I have a frieze of all, most of the shows that I've done, the front page, you know, the shows are for a long period of time, 2, 3, 5, 6 years, whatever they are. But, what is that?
It's a microphone.
So, anyway, he's
Mel, retired.
That was 1945. And our cast included somebody, Gail Robbins, and Mel Torme. I remember his little agent came to me that time. We were with Music Corporation of America. And he says... we got this group. It's a dandy group. He says, you'll like it. It's called Mel Torme and his Monotones. it's a catchy name, you know. It was Mel Torme and his Meltones. You know, that was his, So here, this is his agent.
Well, that's par for the course.
And, actually, I didn't like him. I'm being honest with you, but... everybody did, and MCA, you know, put it in such a way that we couldn't very well refuse. So we hired him. That was actually the start, as far as I know, of Mel Torme.
He's done all right, though, since then, I guess, hasn't he?
In spite of it, yes.
He was pretty young at that time. He was must have been just a late teenager or something.
He wasn't that young, but we were all a lot younger.
I hate to say this, but...
Go ahead.
Because you'll cut me down. I was doing a movie with Bing and several other people.
Bing who?
I forget. I came on the set, on the stage, this particular morning, and I'm walking along past the portable dressing rooms, and all of a sudden I hear this voice say, "Hi, Liz Tremaine." I turn around, I say, "Hi. You're Mel Torme." "Yeah, I've never met you. How are you?" He says, "You've met me." He says, "I did my first bit on the first Nighter show way back in the 30s.
1910.
When I was just a kid, you know, 1908.
I should have let you tell your story first.
Yeah, it was much shorter.
Well, he couldn't have been, what was he, about six?
Yeah, he was just a kid.
Yeah.
Kid actor.
Yeah.
Before he ever thought of singing.
Before he lost his voice, huh?
Dresser, you were saying that the ABC and NBC shared offices here, but they also shared studios here, didn't they?
Oh, yeah, sure.
So after the split up from the red and the blue,
mm-hmm.
And so there would be times when you would be in the same studio, but an ABC program might come out of there, and the same as an NBC program.
Oh, yeah. They'd follow one another a lot. I was just thinking about that. And announcers had a lot of problems. Like Mike Stokey, I remember so well. Okay. Pantomime quiz, remember that? Well, Mike Stokey was on our staff at the... I think he was a junior announcer, wasn't he?
I think so. They made him a junior announcer.
I think so, yeah.
After that.
And my, know, but we do a lot of standby on the network, because at that time, they were running over a lot of times, you know, like the Bob Hope and all of the shows got wound up, and they weren't getting off on time. So they came down, NBC came down with an edict that, by golly, everything had to get off right on time. It didn't matter what they were doing. And so they'd run this thing through a booth and sign an announcer there. And he was told that when that gets to 29:30 or whatever it is, hit the button and say, this is ABC, NBC, and that's it. And so Mike Stokey, he was doing that, and he came down to the end, and they're still going on. He pushed the button. He said, this is the, well, it's a red, no, I don't know. Well, what does it matter?
mentioning Mike Stokey, dropping his name, reminds me that he started the program on KTLA Armchair Detective, a television show.
Yeah.
And he hired me. He hired H. Allen Smith and myself, but we weren't hired. I wasn't paid. It was early television. You had to get in on the ground floor. Armchair Detective. It ran about a year and a half, from about 49 until 51. And that was my first experience in television. Not my really first experience in television, but my early experience in television. And
I hate to tell you about my first television.
Yeah.
1939.
It was a very interesting thing for me. I went into television later when I left Lux in 1952.
Mm-hmm. When was your first...
Thank you. I thought you'd never ask. No. 1939, W9XYZ, Zenith Experimental Station in Chicago. Mm-hmm. And we did the whole thing in an area about the size of this.
Mm-hmm.
And I was the host, White Tie and Tails.
What year was that?
39.
See, that's why I let him tell his story first.
Yeah. Now, he's going back to 1908 again. Anyway, I lost... I was a skinny guy, and in 45-minute show, I lost 8 pounds. It was 140 degrees in the studio.
Hot.
No air conditioning. No incidental music. I had to crawl out of the scene where I was the host. They didn't even turn the cameras off. You know, the viewing box was about that big, about 3x4, and inches, that is. And I crawled out of the one scene, and I didn't have a breakaway. I had to take off this outfit and put on a business suit, shirt and tie, and open the show, because I was the leading man in the show, too. And they said, get in on this. On the ground floor, boy, you'll go places.
This is important to get in on the ground floor of television. And that, in that run of the Armchair Detective, an actor, Nestor Paiva, no longer with us.
Yes.
Nestor Paiva was murdered and put in a box.
Literally?
Well, no, not really.
Should have been.
This is what we saw on camera. But then they forgot to take a camera off him. And he came out of the box. This air.
Well, like the show with Ellen Mowbray we did for Climax here, you know. I've been, people argue with me, including Johnny Carson, that it wasn't Ellen Mowbray, it was somebody else. But I was standing 20 feet from him. And it was a day, this is the big Climax show from Chrysler. And he... nobody was quite sure what they were doing. It was a very big show. It was on CBS over the new building. And it was a serious thing where Mowbray was killed. And they had him in the living room and a blanket over him. And so then they went to this other shot over here, which was cut away from him, or supposed to, but they didn't. And the... The floor manager gave him the wrong cue, and on this is before tape or anything like that. And here's the guy. He picked up his bed and walked. He got up.
He had seen that show on Armchair Detective, and that's why they did it that way.
They didn't plan on it. They really raised hell. But anyway, I got to answer my friend over there, whose name I can't think of. Getting a little older.
That's Les Tremaine.
Yes.
Thank you, John. He's nasty, isn't he?
My first experience in television, and this is documented, and you can look it up.
Oh, I will, too.
1929.
Yes.
And it was at Schenectady, New York. And there weren't any sets. And there wasn't a hell of a lot of television either, but I mean, it was I had my orchestra, and I was playing at the...
Can you document that?
Yes.
All right.
A lot of people are still mad at it. I was playing at the Bandbox, the Tonic Hotel in Albany, New York, and they asked me to come up to Schenectady. That's where the, whatever the big...
Westinghouse, probably.
No, it wasn't Westinghouse, but...
I knew it wouldn't be.
But in your store.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's not very interesting, but I've got a few more that I could put to the sleep with two of you.
How long did you have a band, Wendell?
Well, I started out, I mean, nobody had ever asked me that. Most people ever do ask, how did you start in the business? I was going to school in the University of Montana. I always wanted to go to China. So I never knew anybody ever been to China, but I wanted to go. It fascinated me. So I heard that they hired orchestras to go on these boats to China, the Oriental Lines, the Admiral Lines. So I wrote him this fantastic letter, and I got a letter back from him and said, from the chief passenger agent's matter, and he said, this is, we've never hired a band sight unseen before, but if your orchestra is one-tenth as good as you say it is, we don't feel that we have the right to deprive our passengers of this great musical treat. Says you sail February 22nd, whatever it was, from Pier 41 in Seattle. Well, that's fine, except the only trouble was I didn't have an orchestra. I didn't play anything. But anyway, we did. We had time enough. I went out and got a band together. They taught me to play drums. And then I was in, until the crash of 29. Let me see, I would go. Yeah, that's quite a long period of time at that, because I was in China in 24.
Boxer Rebellion. No.
I'm glad you mentioned that. I was a boxer.
He rebelled.
Champion of Montana.
You mentioned my
earphone is making a noise. Yeah. I was in Wyoming with my grandson in September, and I damn near ruined my whole hearing structure. They shooting some big guns back there.
Oh.
But anyway, that's from 20. I was in Europe. And I replaced Whiteman on the Leviathan. And
that's just before it sank. No.
This is pretty fascinating, pretty interesting. And I came back, and the first show of its kind ever on CBS. It was in Steinway Hall. People argue with me about that, too. See, CBS was never in Steinway Hall.
Oh, yes, they were.
I said, I wonder what we were doing there. The boss was there smoking a cigar. But we did pretending that we were on a ship. It was supposed to have been a broadcast from the Leviathan, and we did it in the studio.
You mentioned 1929. In 1929, I was in high school, and the teacher of photography there, had been on staff at Fox Studios. He taught photography. Anyway, he brought a man to do a demonstration of television for us with the scanning disc. This was scanning disc television earliest days of it, which dates me. But I don't know.
You're just
mentioned Lum and Abner a little while ago. Yeah. I'm studying up on as much stuff as I can find around the house.
I'm going to be a guest at the Lum and Abner convention.
Are
this
you
year.
Really?
Oh.
Mm.
Can you imagine?
Yes.
And I said, well, where is it? And he said, well, you fly to Little Rock.
That's right.
And then we will meet you. And 2.5 hours later, we'll be in Mena, Arkansas.
That's right next to the, you know, what were the, where do the boys have their
Pine
store?
Ridge.
Pine Ridge.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Mena's right next to Pine Ridge. You drive, because Pine Ridge only has about
18
people that live there. The store is there.
Yeah.
That's interesting, because I was the guest 3 years ago.
Were you?
Yeah, I guess.
Jerry Hausner was there
two years ago.
Yeah. And went back another year. They loved him so much, he had so many stories. He says, I can't go back again. I want to make more stories.
I know you guys have more stories, but we have to take a pause for just a minute or two. So stick around. We're talking with Wendell Niles, John M. Kennedy, Dresser Dahlstedt, and Les Tremaine, talking about the good old days. And it's such a pleasure to sit around this big round table here at the Pacific Pioneer Broadcasters. We'll be right back.
Cut, Norm.
Well, we've gotten the signal from Marty Halperin and Norman Dews, and we're ready to continue with our conversation here at the Pacific Pioneer Broadcasters Clubhouse with four legendary names from the days of radio. We have Wendell Niles, John M. Kennedy, and the M stands for Milton, Dresser Dahlstedt, and Les Tremaine.
And I spell with one S.
One S.
I've been getting mail lately, L-E-double-S. Okay.
Did any of you ever, when you first started as an announcer, did you ever, ever believe that somebody would call you legendary?
But you know, you really are. People who listened to the radio had their image of what you looked like, and the announcer was always the person who was in control. Even on a wild, crazy comedy show
or whatever it was,
he was the one who was in control.
I believe that. That sounds splendid. I'm in favor of that.
Will you vote on it?
Well, John, I'd listen to the Lux Radio Theater, and we would hear your voice. A voice of authority, yet it was a very warm voice talking about Lux toilet soap. And you would be interviewing occasionally a starlet who would say that she did her duds in Lux, or
almost invariably a starlet.
Libby Collins wasn't she on
there?
She
gets every day, right? Libby Collins was a legendary person. It was an actress. Mm-hmm. Dorothy Lovett, most of the time, or a part of the time, did the part of Libby Collins, and many people thought that Libby Collins was an actual person.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. Dorothy Lovett is still around. I have seen her within the last couple of years. As a matter of fact, we went to Doss Butler's, the late Doss Butler's...
Memorial?
Not memorial. She didn't go to the memorial. I went to that, but he had a class that met every Wednesday evening for years. I was there a year and a half. He wrote prolifically, and then...
A clever man.
Clever man with a wonderful voice, a wonderful personality and talent, and then we would act out some of the material that he had written.
John, on the Lux programs, you were it was tightly scripted, wasn't it? Everything was scripted.
Oh, yes.
There was no ad-libbing. Even the little commercials where they would in between. And then finally the curtain call when the stars would come out and try to sound spontaneous. But basically they were all reading from prepared script.
Always. Radio in those days, at least certainly on Lux Radio Theater, was by script. And
quite true.
I was never really relaxed. I was always uptight.
Well, the lawyers always had to check it and everything was in.
Yeah, right.
And I had the Tom show, and Eddie came in one day for that commercial, you know, and I said to the producer, "You kidding with this?" He says... he said it's been approved and everything is written from New York. And I said, you're going to make a big bowling alley out of the CBS studio here. It was a... So he said, you read it the way it is. Okay. I said, well, it was a serious show, and I got one of the biggest laughs I've had in a long time.
Oh, boy.
I said, I'll tell you the line. I said, take Tums and kiss your acid indigestion goodbye.
Well, you know, and in those days, we have to stress the fact that in those days the air was very pure and clean.
Oh yes.
The first nighter show, Barbara Luddy and myself, the two leads, didn't dare on the show smoke, drink. You couldn't say heck or darn or anything that
pregnant,
smacked
you. You couldn't say a word like that.
And if you made a mistake, you figured you'd better put on your hat and go because you were fired.
Yeah.
Well, there was this radio station in town that practiced that.
Yeah.
I didn't get fired there that way, but I left.
Were you there during the Sonny Tufts episode there? With
As a matter of fact, I asked the movies, Joseph Cotton, if he had actually said that. Yeah, you've heard it back there.
He said
The old joke. The next week, the cast boy, so-and-so, Sonny Tufts. that was the inflection that he allegedly used. I asked him if he actually did that, and he said, oh, they say I did. But
did he?
Well,
Norm Blackburn.
No, he wouldn't admit it. Yeah.
You know, Norm Blackburn, he's the one, he was head of that at that particular time with
J. Walter Thompson.
And the problem was, it was during the war, and it was hard to get people. Now, Sonny Tufts actually was a real good actor.
Yeah, he was
He was a good singer, a good performer, but he was an alcoholic. And somehow he got like Vice President Quayle. Somehow, you know, it was a Tufts a bashing thing to do. And he was a much better person. I could... in fact, maybe I will tell you about Sonny. But anyway, you mentioned the star, what was he?
Joseph Cotton.
Yeah, Cotton. See, they couldn't get people, and Norm was up, and he had a real tough time. You can get girls, because there were plenty of stars, girl stars, but during the war, it's hard to get the male stars. But usually, you know, how he was at the end, and he would say, "Be tuning in, you know, next week, and we're going ahead and so forth." And he didn't have a chance to read it over, because Norm didn't have it either until about...
they didn't want anybody to know.
Well, they didn't know. He couldn't find it. He finally got a Johnny Test, but it... and he dashed in, and while they were almost ready to sign off, they were... And they hand it to Joe Cotton, and he gets his, you know how you've done so many times. And so, ladies and gentlemen, we're very happy to tell you that next week we have that great actor, Sonny Tufts. That was a sad thing about
it. Yes.
Sonny he was really a good performer. I was my roommate one time at a cancer thing down in Phoenix, but. He would defy all medical science. He would drink maybe, you've heard of we can drink one, he'd drink at least 2 quarts of whiskey a day. And and people say that'll kill you, because it does, but it took a long time for him. And
he was a big guy.
He was a big guy. Big guy, and wonderful. He was. He was a big guy.
Yeah.
I we have a little lab dissolve here, and fine, and I was in New York. Coming down Madison Avenue, and I see Sonny Tufts coming. And he sees me and greets me, and I said, "Gee, it's good to see you, Sonny. What are you doing?" He said, "I'm going to open in a big play." It was like Bye Bye Birdie. I can't remember. It was a big thing. And I said, "How's your drinking?" He said, "Haven't had a drink in 6 months." He reeked of bourbon. Right. It's sad. You know, here's a guy.
Terribly sad.
A big... And he said, "I want you to be there." He said, "You come." He said, "Look, you come to the stage door and come back to him. You're my guest. And come, and I'll meet you there." And I did. I went, and I showed up, but Sonny didn't.
Oh, dear.
Wendell Niles.
it was really sad. It broke my heart, because here's a sweet man, a talented man.
Yes.
Too bad. A great chance for a whole brand-new thing.
One of my dearest friends early on in radio. As a matter of fact, he was the first leading man on the first nighter show, which opened on Thanksgiving night, 1930, at a little station called WIBO before it moved to NBC.
And he was a wonderful man. He looked to me, I was, 17, 18 years old, so I had no comparative basis. I didn't know about age, and when you look at somebody, well, they're 60 or 70, you know. But I thought he was about 60, 65 years old. He had the most beautiful voice, and he was the finest actor I think I have ever worked with.
Sonny Taft? Are you talking about...
No. Oh, I'm talking about another man, and I don't want to malign him. He's long gone. I won't even mention his name. But he was the most horrible alcoholic.
Yeah.
And he had every show in town. He was a wonderful leading man. And he had gray eyes that the girls just loved, between the eyes and the voice. It didn't matter that he was thin and gray and balding and so on. He would get drunk. Every show had to be recast. And I was a pretty good friend of his. And I knew what had happened about the third time it happened. And he would be gone for 6-8 weeks. And I used to track him down in these flea bags on Clark Street in Chicago and find him and try to sober him up and bring him back. I was with him when he died. He had been drinking formic acids. And he was a mess. No point in going into it. But this man, he'd had a very tragic life. I made his headstone when he was buried, and he was 35 years old. But that's what liquor had done to him, and the tragedies in his life, because he had lost two twin boys and so on, and a terrible thing out here. And he was born in 1900, and he died in 1935. But I will never forget this man. He's a marvelous actor.
We had a lot of them out here the same way. But you realize,
thing.
I'm speaking of age, you know, that most of these people are talking about, they never made 50. You know, you don't believe it. You know, guys like Bogart, Errol Flynn, people, they never got to be 50 years old.
Yeah.
Well, what's the secret of your longevity, gentlemen?
Well,
you drink a lot.
Good life?
I really don't.
Well, I've Dewar's White Label is mine. I don't know about yours.
Mm-hmm. I've walked all over that. What did you say? I'm sure it was funny.
It was.
Well, you tell us. You're not going to tell us?
I don't do a repeat show since we used to do it for the West Coast.
Yeah.
You remember?
The stories about the repeats.
Well,
the West
you talk about drinking, and certainly it is something that is a horrible disease.
Yeah.
But I've heard stories over the years of the people who would really
didn't make
step
the
off the wagon between the first and the second broadcast. They would get lost.
That's true.
You had 3 to 4 hours to kill some time.
You get out of the Derby and you have a few drinks and you come back. And
the
Those
Derby
are interesting
must have
times.
Been a heck of a place in those days. That's within a block or so from here. It's right between Hollywood and Sunset on Vine Street.
Right, right across the street from Lux Radio Theater originated.
One of the most famous restaurants in the world.
Oh.
I used to get my, like, Louis L'Amour. You ever read any of his books?
Yeah.
Guys, I knew back there when he just... had his first hit, Hondo. And, you know, those things, you go back. He's dead now, just died last year.
Yeah,
that was a very fascinating place, the Derby was.
Well, Sardi's was the same way in New York, you know.
Yeah.
And Sardi's was not close to NBC or to CBS or any of it, but we used to go there between shows. I was sitting there with some other people, and Ben Grauer joined us one night. And he had a repeat at I don't know what time. And we got into a big discussion about something, and he forgot all about his repeat show. And he was in the middle of a story, and somebody looked up and said, Ben, what time do you go on? He says, 11 o'clock or something like that. And they said, well, it's 11 now. I never saw anybody move so fast in my life. Funny stories about New York. You know.
There were so many of those, and I guess it happened almost to every show at some time or another, where you set the clock ahead of time, you know, so that...
Yeah.
When we were doing one man's... it was I Love a Mystery, I guess. we'd go to the Derby, and Carl Morris would do the first show, and then he'd take over, take off, and he'd give the production to a fellow general and NBC producer, Mike Dutton. And Mike was a great guy, and everybody liked him and everything, but we'd all gone to the Derby, and we came back, and while Mike was gone, we did the thing with the clock, you know, set the thing back and went a whole bit. And so when we came on, the light goes on, and Paul Carson, who was the organist at the time, he hit the worst clinkers you could ever imagine. Terrible clinkers. And, of course, I started announcing, and I would stumble all over the stuff and introduce the cast, and in would come Mike Raffetto and all those people, just terrible, and laughing, and the whole bit. This poor Mike Stokey, I'll never forget the look on his face, you know. And, and finally, of course, let him know what had been happened. Oh, yeah. It was a terrible thing to do. It's just awful.
I have a real one for you. I don't know whether this has ever happened to any of you famous voices. I was the host on the Hallmark of Hall of Fame out of New York. And Tom Shirley, somebody mentioned him here a little earlier. Yeah. We were talking about Tom. He was a fine announcer. And he announced Merton Marge for years and years and years out of Chicago. And we had rehearsed during the day. And, of course, in those days we had a couple of movie stars as our guest stars on the drama. I am supposed to open the show. And everything had gone beautifully during rehearsal. And I stepped up to the mic, opened my mouth. Nothing came out. I had laryngitis up to my nose, you know. For no reason. Nothing had happened that would make it that way. And Tom, to show you how instantaneous the reactions were, like any of you, he was across the mic from me. And as soon as I opened the show, he came in and did the first commercial. And when he saw that I didn't even have time to panic my eyes, you know, he took over immediately. There wasn't a second's pause. And he did my part, and he did his part. And I went home in the car listening to the show.
Well, they literally did hold the whole thing together. Mm-hmm. There's no question about it.
Any of you ever have such an experience?
Yes.
I bought Hallmark cards anyway, Les.
In spite of everything.
He cared enough, see?
I did Hallmark payoffs out here for a long time, too. But I was thinking about Edward G. Robinson. We're thinking about taking over, like my brother was doing this show with Edward G. Robinson. He was, you know, one that played all the tough parts and Al Capone, all the rest. So that was his radio. And the kid with the muffs, you know, that you see him all the time. He's a sound man, Ray.
Oh, Erlenborg.
Yeah, Erlenborg. Yeah. Hundred thousand shows I've done with him. But he got excited. It was an exciting scene in there. Of course, you got the audience out here, and you got the stage up here, and no cameras or anything. And it was a big crash, and he got overdid it a little bit, and he had a broken box, and the box went up and hit. It came down and cut a pretty good gash in his forehead, and he started to bleed. And here's Edward G. Robinson, big, you know, he's played Jack London, all of the things when he'd crush people's hands, shot people. And here is Edward G. Robinson, and he sees this blood, and he faints.
Oh, my.
Faints.
Yes.
Dead away. Now, what do you do? So Kenny is the announcer. He comes in. He does Edward G. Robinson until I could get the guy back on his feet, you know. Mm-hmm. But that's
a terrible thing. Yeah. Glad that happened to be in real life with a friend of mine who had a show up in Pasadena on some station. And we went to Musso Frank's over here for lunch. And I had a bad truck accident up at my place up north and had badly broken my arm, and I was all bloodied up and so on. And we were sitting there talking, and I wasn't looking at him particularly, and I mentioned blood, and I turned around, and he was out cold on the bench alongside of me. I had never seen this before.
And he was a doctor.
Terrible.
Yeah. While we're dropping names, I will drop the name of Cecil B. DeMille.
Oh, yeah.
Many people have asked me, Was I chummy with Sesame?
Was anybody? Yeah.
Was anybody?
Yeah, right,
yeah.
Right. Yeah.
I was on the show about a year. He had a secretary always with him, telling him about the lines where who he was to say this and that. And I was just at one of the rehearsals. I was just on the other side of the curtain from him and his secretary, and she was telling him, "You say this, and then Kennedy says that, and then you say." He said, "Kennedy." Who's Kennedy? Which hurt. And I thought that hurt. But when Bob Cummings was on a Pacific Pioneer Broadcasters program, a tribute to Lux, and he said that he had been on that show 10 years, 10 times, and had never met Cecil B. DeMille.
Yeah.
William Keeley, who replaced him, was an entirely different story. William Keeley and his lovely wife, Genevieve Tobin, were delights.
Oh, yes.
Delights.
Yes. Yeah. Well, you know, you're talking about the secretary always being with him.
Yes.
I had an attorney in New York named Bill Feitelson, and he was quite a well-known attorney. And he had offices on Fifth Avenue and so forth. And I'm walking down the street one day, and here comes this little guy. I didn't see his face, but I could tell who it was immediately. He was always going away, you know. And he was shouting at the top of his voice over the traffic, the milling crowd on the sidewalks on Fifth Avenue. And he, running up behind him was his secretary, this girl, running along and making notes on her stenographic pad.
Like Donovan Winters.
Sorry, I went away there. Everybody's gone.
I noticed that.
I got carried away.
Dresser, did you ever have any panic type situations that you either saved or someone saved for you?
Not that I can remember. We were doing a show with Ben Alexander once, and we were all ready to go. I was announcing it, and it was an audience participation show. That's the only, as close as I can remember. And just before we were to go on the air, all of a sudden Ben fainted and he was gone.
Yeah.
And apparently he'd had a heart attack.
Oh, my.
So I did what everybody did at the time. I just took over and did the whole show and did it for a couple of weeks, I guess. But Ben recovered, and he was okay after that. But,
was that, yeah. That wasn't Queen for a Day, was it?
No, it was. I can't remember the name of it. It was on ABC, and I can't remember now the name of it. But it was an audience participation show. And Ben was a great guy. He was a wonderful fellow to work with, but that was a bit of a shock. But you respond to those things so fast, you know. You just ought to
came up the hard way, like everybody's all did. You know, you come to the local stations, they can't make you laugh. Well, without, well, some exceptions, like my brother Kent. if he started to laugh, that's it. Forget it. And there was a case where it was the reverse happened. It was on Chesterfield, I believe, one of the big shows. And something, he couldn't help it, and he started to laugh during a commercial. And coast to coast, a top show, big. What do you do?
What
so Mel Blanc is here. Here's a man of 1,000 voices, and he's got 1,000 voices, but that doesn't include a straight voice. So he takes over, and he does the commercial from Kenny. This, I don't think it's ever happened before
in
the history of the world. And speaking of that, one of the great breakups, I don't know if you were around, you must have been. You remember when they to do the Hollywood Hotel?
Oh, yes, yes.
And they did it at the Figaro Playhouse downtown.
Mm-hmm.
But Kenny, my brother, was the announcer, and he's also one of the producers. He was, you know, he produced it with, can't think of the guy's name, but it was a great show. It was one of the top shows
this
on
the
air.
This is Luella
Parsons.
Yeah,
the big show.
Yeah, sure.
Luella Parsons, she was the... Mm-hmm. And she'd bring everybody in that says, "Oh, yes, honey, I want you to be there tonight, and you will be there next week." And so she got to Mae West, and she says, "Mae West, may you be there?" She says, "If you look very closely, you'll see it's not me." And that's not the story I started to tell, because because she was the only one that ever told her to go shove it, and she wouldn't do it. So she was blacklisted in every Hearst paper. They wouldn't even handle ads for pictures. Mm-hmm. And that was May, and I could tell you another story the next time we all meet here.
Yeah,
about
2010.
They tell in the stories. But I started to tell about Hollywood Hotel. They had Igor Gorin, the great tenor, remember?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And they had wrote the music for the Lord's Prayer.
Oh, dear.
He put the first prayer to music.
I don't know, but it's beautiful.
It was Martin Luther King, wasn't it?
No.
John Charles Thomas.
It was a trio. Somebody said
it was Martin Luther, probably.
Only Kennedy that can find his pants. That doesn't mean that you're... they were sponsored, of course, you know, by... Campbell Soup.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
And they went all out. They did everything they had in those days, the Collier's and Life and all of the magazines, big full-page ads. Igor Gorin is going to sing for the first time the music, the Lord's Prayer. And it was tremendous. So we got down, it's at the Figaro Playhouse. This is before tape for anything. You know, we're talking.
Yeah.
And Kenny, Dick Powell was the MC. Kenny was the announcer. And Raymond Page and his orchestra, you know. Mm. So he said, ladies and gentlemen, now, everybody was waiting for this big scene, coast to coast. The theater was full, of course. And Dick gives it a nice build-up. The first time... anywhere in the world, a great tenor, ladies and gentlemen, Igor Gorin. And at first he said it would be kind of nice if you'd bow your head, you know, mm-hmm. the whole way. And ladies and gentlemen, the great tenor, Igor Gorin, in the Lord's Prayer. So he started, you know, that... My Father. And he went and the whole till he get... Hallowed be thy name. And he froze.
Oh.
He absolutely froze. Oh. Well, what do you do? You know, the band, it straggled off like they were. And there's no saying we can't take it over. This is it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Now you got Dick, of course, he froze. There's all MCs like that. They don't know. The announcers, the producer, he said, for God's sake, do something. Kenny, do something. Here's again. Nobody can do anything but the announcer, Prophet Kenny.
Yeah.
And this is where it comes, those years and years and years of experience that we're all talking about, coming up to hardware through these little stations. So Kenny said, my God, what do I do? Things that go through my mind. What do I say? He said, I'll go, yeah, I'm sorry, folks, old Igor blew it. Say that. No. So he said, ladies and gentlemen, may I have your, whatever the word was, he used indulgence or something. But he said, obviously you can see that Mr. Gorin just became overwhelmed with the he choked up because of the, you know, the what this really meant to him. Mm-hmm. The really tried the jerk. He forgot his lines. He forgot the whole damn thing. And he blew it. So he said, "With your indulgence, we'll now we
do it again,
ladies and gentlemen. Yeah, if you'll Igor Gorin and the Lord's Prayer. This time was." Fantastic, you know, when you hit those big Bach chords at the end of that thing, you know, like that wasn't a dry seat in the house. It was there, coast to coast, and people went crazy. We were 3 minutes over, nobody cared. Never something like it.
Run out and buy 3 minutes more time.
Nobody cared. I tell you, it was.
That's amazing.
At our ages, we begin to think more and more about hereafter.
Yes,
you walk into a room and say to yourself, what did I come in here after?
Well, I have to know, what I came here after was a great conversation with some nice people, and it's been amazing. I can't tell you how much it's meant to myself and our listening audience to spend this time with you guys.
It's been tremendous, hasn't it?
We've remained
this. Some other time when you have 3 days, I will do and tell you the real truth.
We can send you some more tapes.
This rolled by so quickly, but... we really appreciate this, and I want to thank you all for the contributions you made to the great radio days, because they really were great, and they're greater because of your contributions.
You've made us feel very comfortable.
Very easy, very relaxed, and I'm very pleased that you came out to see the Pioneer Broadcasters in their lounge and club room, and yesterday you were at the... at the luncheon, which with Donald O'Connor, which was so good.
The red carpet was rolled out for us, and we appreciate that. Extend that invitation to you. Come to Chicago. Okay. You've got a lot of fans there who would like to see you in person.
It'd be fun.
And,
tell them about
museum.
My book, Chuck, when you get there.
I'm very happy to have had this opportunity with the rest of us to do this sort of a show for a man like you, young as you are, who has the feel for old-time radio that you have, and know so much about it, and love it so much.
Well, you've made this joy for us, too.
Who's going to hear this, incidentally?
My wife.
Tell her about my book, will you?
Thank you, Wendell Niles, John Milton Kennedy, Dresser Dahlstedt, and Les Tremaine. Thank you very much, John.
Thank you. Cut, Norm.